you do the work and you put everything in place and you're ready, you're going to do well. Your likelihood of doing well is much, much higher than kind of being there, hoping for the best. I hated living that way. And we had a couple years where that was kind of the attitude. I was like, this isn't good enough. I'm not here to hope. I'm here to win and to really maximize my potential. And that comes from understanding. You have to be a student of whatever you're trying to achieve. You have to really tear it down.
Welcome to the Sparks of Gratitude podcast. I am Randy Sparks. We are grateful for you. And you know it, that gratitude can change or save lives. And we are here to share amazing stories with amazing people. And today we've got one of those, Stephen Nyman. Welcome.
Hi, hi.
Yeah, we're super excited to have Stephen here, who I've actually known since we were both very young children, playing in the snow. And Steve is a professional skier, multi-time Olympian, husband, father, friend, and just an all-around awesome dude. So we are
glad to be here.
I'm psyched. Yep, and I believe you because you're awesome. And in fact, you're on your way to go skiing as soon as this is done.
Yes, sir.
So when this is published, you know, it might not be ski season anymore, you know, in a month or two. But anyway, you're going skiing today. Well, you grew up here where we record in Utah, in a small town in Utah called Sundance is where you grew up. Tell me a little bit.
You're on the other side of the mountain. It's kind of cool. We're right underneath Mount Tippinogus, which is where Sundance is, which is where we both grew up. And it's what raised us, raised me, and kind of formed me to become one of the best in the world at ski racing.
Yeah, and you really are one of the best in the world and maybe didn't imagine that that would have happened when you were a kid skiing at Sundance.
I don't know. Actually, as a kid, you imagine all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And you have these dreams inside of you, and that was one of my dreams. It was either being like Karl Malone and John Stockton in my front yard, or it was ski racing.
Well, when you were that young, did you know that you'd end up being this tall? Maybe you could have been.
I had no clue I'd be player. This tall. And growing up in the mountains, we really didn't rub shoulders with high school sport, general sport. Mm. It was all individual sport, biking and hiking and camping and exploring and skiing. And so just to have that mountain, that playground right in front of us to raise us, I had three brothers, and that mountain raised us. The employees of Sundance raised us. We were just kind of let loose to kind of figure it out, and my brothers helped push each other's heights. So they definitely push my heights, and I hope I push theirs.
Yeah, well, and I'm, because Sundance raised me too, I'm pretty familiar with it, but could you describe it a little bit for people who don't know what Sundance is like?
Sundance, so I've traveled the entire world skiing. I've New Zealand, South America, Europe, Russia, Asia, like I've been all over skiing. Sundance, to me, the Alps is incredibly special. And there's some cool places in Utah, and Utah's known for their dry powder, but Sundance is just like the Alps. Just this, you're underneath these massive mountains, and it's a small little hill. It has everything you need, though. It's small yet complex, and it's very special. It's been taken care of. It hasn't been taken over, run over by the conglomerates that are skiing in America these days. It has this Americana feel. It has this touch. It's got a very settling vibe. Once you enter into the valley, you drive up Provo Canyon, and then you go up Sundance Canyon. And as you're going up Sundance Canyon, it's just this tight little canyon, and all of a sudden opens up into this big bowl, and you're underneath this 12,000-foot peak, and you're just kind of encompassed.
It is pretty amazing, isn't it, kind of looking up at that cirque? Mm-hmm. Where you think, you know, I've traveled the world too, and you go to amazing places to see amazing things. And then I pause when I lived at Sundance as well, and then think, you know, there are people from all over the world coming to visit my backyard.
It's
and ski.
I pinch myself backyard. Every time I just go into that valley. I'm just, or not valley, the opening there. I'm just like, wow, this is where I grew up. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, and you talked a little bit about the community that raised you there, too. It was mm-hmm. you and your brothers and the mountain and the Sundance community. It really is a community mountain mm-hmm. where it has that small town feel, it really a community feel. Mm-hmm. It's like you go to Sundance and you know you're going to see your friends there.
And you know you'll see friends, get in trouble, somebody's there to help you. You know, there's just these people that are there that are raising each other and supporting each other. And that's a super special thing. Is these mega resorts, you kind of get there and you feel lost and you're in a rat race. And I don't feel that there at all.
And they even let you have your dog run on the mountain with you when we were kids.
Well, funny story. We named our dog after Randy because we thought Randy was so cool when we were kids. So we got this golden retriever. My parents are like, what do we name the dog? And we all got together and we're like, we want to name him Randy. So
yeah, but there's
our
no
dog
way
was
that
named after this man.
Well, anyway, the dog was faster than me on the hill. So, but I remember that dog. That dog was awesome. Hello, everyone. I want to thank you so much for listening to the Sparks of Gratitude podcast. If you like what you're listening to, will you please hit that like, subscribe to this, and tell us what you like about it in the comments. That'll help us get great guests and keep this thing going. Now back to our interview. Well, so as you said, you had these dreams like as a child. I remember thinking like, oh, I'm going to be in the Olympics someday and this and that. And you and I were both at different ages on the Sundance ski team when we were kids. And I was just a bit older than you. And so tell me the story of how this happened. I mean, that we weren't built as a farm mm-hmm. for professional ski racers.
Yeah. And Sundance was a stepping stone yeah. for me to get to where I got. But there actually have been a lot of people that have come out of Sundance that have yeah. carved out a piece of the skiing pie. The Benuses, Steve Benus, yeah. his dad, Junior Benus, who's 98, still skiing, rips.
Yeah, and is a legend in the ski world.
In this Utah ski world, he is a legend. And his son, Steve, made the U.S. ski team. But they all started at Tim Haven before Sundance. And then there was me, but during our generation, I don't know if you remember Kim and Alicia Stevens,
yeah.
they made the ski team. Eric Fisher temporarily was at Sundance for a little bit. He made the ski team. At one point, we had several people from Sundance on the U.S. ski team, and I was like, they had a stint at Sundance at some yeah. time. And I was like, wow,
it was
kind of cool.
The class that you came up in was something special.
Yeah, but then from there, I at 16, I decided to commute to Park City, and there are a lot of good, talented kids there at that time. There's this nucleus of talent that just really competed and pushed each other to different levels, and I finagled. We didn't have the money to go to a ski academy or anything like that, so I finagled a thing through high school and said, all right, I don't need to do PE. This is what I do. This is what I want to do. I want to ski in the Olympics, and this is how I train, so they gave me credit for that, and then I don't need to do art. I'll do it in the summer at Sundance because it's an art community as well. All these artists come up. So I was learning from professional ceramists and painters how to do all this stuff, jewelry. And I ended up not having to do art so I could get out at noon, drive to Park City and train up there. And I made it through that program. At that time, Park City had a World Cup going on up there. So I was able to see what the true professionals were like. I was able to ski on that run and realize, okay, I can do this. I'm capable of skiing on this piece and skiing fast on this piece. I can compete with these guys and just chip my way up to World Juniors. Ended up winning as a nobody from the Park City ski team and then onto the U.S. team and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. Well, there's a little bit more to it than that, Steve.
I don't know if you want to go through that. But.
Well, I one thing, when you said kind of out of nowhere, unexpected, you went to the World Junior Championships mm-hmm. and ended up winning the gold.
Yeah.
And so were you, if I remember right, mm-hmm. I don't remember that you were maybe an alternate or something on that
yeah.
team to race in that. Maybe tell me.
I was a discretionary pick.
Okay.
I had won some earlier races that season. Everybody had their eyes on me.
Yeah.
We had to go to junior nationals, which qualified you for world juniors. And K2 was my sponsor at the time. They were all excited. They gave me all these new skis because I won on these older skis in the beginning of the year. They actually were duct taped and parts of the base were missing and delaminated. And I went out east with all these new skis because I was like, wow, I'm good. Like people are giving me free stuff. This is amazing. And I ended up going out there and those skis didn't hold on ice. It was East Coast. And that was it. I was like, all right, didn't qualify. Going to go to college. kind of over in my mind. Went back home, got on those old skis again, and I was like, these are way better than those skis. And so I ended up doing, went to Europe, did well in a couple races, and they decided to take me on discretion. Well, right before World Juniors, I was at home. The Olympics were happening in 2002 in Park City, and a former coach of mine, Mike Day, was there at that time. He was coaching Bodie Miller at the time, and he came in, and he used to be a K2 guy, and he goes, Steven, try these Fishers. And he gave me some of Bodie's slalom skis, and Bodie was winning World Cups left and right at that time. And I got on him, and I was like, I'm unstoppable. I feel like a god. This is amazing. And I was training next to all the Olympians, training with the Olympians, and I was fast. So then I went to World Juniors, and I was in $10 stretch pants that I bought from the Park City Ski Swap. I was in an old downhill suit, which are like the skin suits that are all tight nylon skin suits we wear. I cut the bottoms off because there's holes all in them. So I had that on the top, and I just had a backwards hat and some goggles. I won. Like, the stretch pants are from the 90s, and they're probably 10 years old. I got them for $10 and I won World Juniors in them. It was great. And I'm on the podium with this guy, Axel Svindal and Mark Berthaud. And Axel's like, who are you? And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, have you raced a World Cup? I'm like, no. Europa Cups, which is the level below World Cup in Europe. It's like, no, I've raced a couple NORAMs and really haven't done anything. And he's just like, how did this kid beat me? You know, this kid had already raced World Cups. He's very good. He's one of the best of all time, actually, if you look at it now. So anyway, I came from nothing, ended up winning. And then I went to World Cup Finals. If you win World Juniors, you get to go to World Cup Finals. And the top 25 people in the world get to go to World Cup Finals, and the guy who won World Juniors. So I go there, and I'm training with all the best in the world beforehand, and I'm beating them all. And I'm just like, wow, I'm really good.
Was that shocking to you? Were you surprised?
Yes. And another funny story is, then Fisher basically gave me all these skis. And my mentality is to like maintain what I have. I had like one pair of skis, take care of those skis type thing. And all of a sudden K2 gave me a bunch of skis. And then I realized, okay, this one worked. The old Fisher gave me a bunch of skis, and I used to ski the wax off, which is not fast, but for some reason I thought it would help, you know? So I had a technician who prepared my skis, got these new GS skis, which I was ranked like 3,000 in the world or something. And I'm with Bodie Miller, Eric Schlope, Michael von Grunigen, Shetal Andrama, like all the best guys in the world. And I'm beating them in giant slalom. And I'm just like, how, what? And I actually grabbed these skis that still had wax on them. He had never even prepared them. And I'm beating all the guys, the best guys in the world, on those skis, not even the ones he prepared. And I get back to the hotel, and I'm like, Robbie, thank you. And he's like, you idiot, you took the wrong skis. And I'm like, well, I was beating everybody on them. And he's like, what? So anyway, I ended up racing slalom at World Cup Finals, and I was shaking in my boots. I'm just like, wow, I'm amongst all my heroes here. And the first run, I was just so slow. I think I was last, whatever that was. So it was a spring day. I got to start first in the second run, because I reversed the start order, and I got sixth on the run, 15th overall, and went from the Park City ski team to the US B team. So kind of cool. Little rise there.
It's really cool. Well, and there were a lot of people here in town that were cheering you on, and I'm one of them. It was a lot of fun to see that.
It's funny on the road, though. You get, especially back then, you didn't know. There wasn't social media. You didn't get these cheers. You didn't feel like people were there. It gets lonely. You're out there by yourself, and it looks glamorous or whatnot, but it's hard. Like, you get beat down, and you're in these waves, this battle of like, all right, am I good enough? What can I do? I'm separated from people. Like, I can make a $10 phone call. I don't have $10, you know, type stuff. It's a funny place to be and look back on, and it's always nice to hear of the support back then and the people paid attention, you know.
Well, it's funny now that I look back and say, well, I didn't have social media back then. I mean, mm-hmm. We had the internet, but it was still kind of new. Mm-hmm. I mean, I mean, not
you'd look at a news article on
the internet. But you know, they were those type of publications and so on. It wasn't, you know, in your face. And I think I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Like I would hear people talk about Stephen, or I'd talk to your dad and he'd give me updates and things like that. That's really fascinating to me, is what it takes for an athlete to compete at that level from, you know, when you were coming up as a kid. There's obviously the physical capacity, but then the mental strength and determination and belief, and then going through this lonely experience where you say sometimes it's amazing and a lot of times it's kind of lonely, and you know, and how do you keep yourself motivated? So what are some of the habits that you developed?
That's really funny, because one of the best movies that really portrays that is not American Downhiller, Downhill Racer, Robert Redford, Sundance. Like,
yeah.
and I didn't really like grasp it until later, but I lived in a lot of those same hotels. I traveled to the same areas. I raced the same courses, and you'd watch that movie and you're like, oh wow, I really relate to this. And he encapsulated it very well. But to me, like, I'd get on a plane until I guess 15 or 16. So I didn't travel the world. And to me, traveling the world was incredible. Like, I gotta get on a plane and I gotta just roam and go. But it's the competitive nature is what would really knock me down. So something that I would really grasp is, where am I? I'm underneath these iconic mountains throughout the world. I'm skiing. I get to ski for a living. I wasn't making much of a living, but I was getting all my costs were paid for, and I was getting to travel the world and ski race and push my limits. And I just had to always ground myself with that. Like, wow, don't get too down on yourself. Like, you're in an incredible place. If things are going poorly, I mean, if things are going great, it's amazing. It's like, what's next? Where are we going next? How can I beat some more people next? You know, like, put them in front of me, let's go. And I would always just find those little things that would help ground me and help me realize, like, how fortunate I am to be experiencing what I was experiencing, and what a beautiful world this is. And I got to grow up in the same situation.
Well, and that's, especially as a teenager, that's a pretty mature perspective to have, to ground yourself with and focus on the, you know, and I eat that up, because this is sparks of gratitude, where you're focusing on, well, what am I grateful for? What do I have here? I'm so fortunate to be under these mountains and be skiing for a living. And was that something that you had inside you, or is this something that people had kind of taught and influenced you with over the years? You know, where did this come from?
I would say it really derived from not growing up with a lot, which is funny saying that I grew up with all, like, underneath these mountains, but I just didn't have a lot. I had to earn what I had. And so I really respected whatever I had. I had one pair of skis. I had to make those skis work. I had to take care of those skis. I didn't mess them up, and I could tell my parents to get me another pair. Like, I had to really respect what I had and make the most of what was put in front of me. So with that attitude, I think I just kind of took that to all the different levels. And even at the World Cup, we were taught so much. One thing that we were taught was to, skiing is so abrasive and tough on the body. Like, so we ski and then we go back to the hotel and we get on the bike and we spin it out and help recover. And then we get ready for the next day's race or run, training runs. And I'd follow that regimen, but I'd have back issues and I would feel lonely and I would feel kind of lost. I'm just living hotel to hotel out of my bag and wouldn't go anywhere. I actually tore my Achilles in 2011, and I realized that sitting on the bike and in ski boots, I'd lose everything I regained quickly. And so I started jogging and walking and running through all the villages and towns where we'd go instead of being on the bike. And that actually helped my back pain, because I'd be upright and not in this ball, which I always am, skiing and sitting and in the car and in life. Like, it's just like good wisdom for life, I guess. But just running and walking, we're made to do that as humans. So, but through that, I got to navigate all these towns and get to know a bunch of different people and the shops I like to go to. And so whenever I get to these new towns and villages, I'd go around and get that experience and get out of the hotel and really realize, oh, wow, this is incredible. This is very cool. This is beautiful. And when I took that approach toward each week's events, that would really, I think, bring some gas to my engine, put some gas in my engine, I guess.
Yeah, through that loan, you're refueling yourself emotionally and mentally and physically.
And just, reminding myself, like, wow, this is absolutely incredible. And I had a lot of teammates that would pay attention to what's going on back home. Oh, it's dumping at home. Oh, there's powder at home. Oh, I miss home. I'm getting homesick. I'm like, you have a mountain shut down for you to go as fast as possible and push your limits. Like, downhill is so rare. You prepared all summer long, like most of your life for this. And you're talking yourself out of it because you want to go ski powder at home. The powder will be there. Like, take advantage of this opportunity to really test your potential. That's what I'd always tell myself as well, and try and tell my teammates just to keep the attitude high, you know?
Well, it sounds like you were kind of a motivating force for them. Who was that for you when you were traveling?
I learned a lot through observation, and I was fortunate to have made the team when Darren and Bodie were on the team. And those two were just on the podium every week. And it was so incredible to watch. And they worked together. And one would step it up. The other would be like, oh, no, watch this. And they'd step forward and they'd step forward. And they just push each other's level to such a unique height. And after Darren retired and then Bodie kind of went on his own, we had this kind of lull in the team. And I wasn't very confident. I called them my dark ages. It was a couple of years of just fighting to stay in there. I finally figured a bunch out with equipment. Skiing's so complex. There's a lot of equipment issues, body issues. I was always good at the beginning of the year, and then I just petered off. And learning how to maintain yourself and compete week in and week out to take that through the entire winter is very tough. And once I figured all this stuff out, I knew we were going to have a good year. And I was right before the season, I wasn't ranked that well. Nobody really was ranked that well, actually. And I ended up finding this Levi vest at the Levi's Outlet in Park City. And it had this big American flag on the back. And I wrote American Downhiller on the sides back here and put some flames on it. And I was just like, all right, whoever's the fastest. I brought it to the team. I said, whoever's the fastest weekend gets to wear the vest. And then it just gets passed on. And you get to write your name inside in the race and blah, blah, blah. Well, that first week, Marco Sullivan was on the podium in Lake Louise. Then I was on the podium in Beaver Creek. And then I won Val Gardena. And then Travis won Santa Catarina. And we're just like, all right, you want to wear this thing? You got to be top five. And then it basically set this precedent to be, you got to be good if you want to have the honor to put your name in this thing. The intention was just to feel cool to wear the thing. And it's like, no. We can be the best. We are good. And you have to be top five to wear this. Or if you're a rookie and you get your first top 10, you can put your name in the thing. And you get to add a little trinket. So there's just all kinds of garbage all over it. And it's a ton of fun. And there's a rich history inside of it. So that kind of, I think, stoked the next wave of downhillers.
Yeah. And where's that vest now?
Still with them.
Passing through the team.
Still collecting names. Hopefully more and more names. Hopefully the boys are hammering.
You started something great there. Well, you talked about something I want to hit on is looking at, you know, when someone might be homesick and you're like, they're closing down a mountain for us. Mm-hmm. We can ski as fast as we want. I mean, remember when we were kids and we wanted to ski as fast as we didn't get the mountain closed down.
No.
Like I remember.
Look out. We're the ski patrol.
Yeah. I remember waiting, you know, to be the last one down the mountain and sit at the top and wait for everybody to leave. And so there's no one on the mountain. So I could just tuck the whole way down and go as fast as I could. We didn't have that option.
Yeah.
But you're a downhill racer. Mm-hmm. So if we describe people who there's different events in ski racing and all of them are essentially, they just get bigger and faster from slalom
is tight turns. GS is kind of like normal turns. Super G's big turns. Downhill's the fastest.
Yeah. You're in a tuck and you're going the fastest. So tell us about what is it like being in a downhill course?
what people don't realize is what the surface of the snow is actually like. They pump millions of gallons of water into each one of these hills every weekend, and they churn it and they just make it wet and they freeze it into a block of ice. And why is because when we push into that, we want it to punch back and we want it to resist and we want it to be reactive and predictable. If it's soft, it could break away and then you're tumbling and you're hurt. So we create a concrete surface for us to go as fast as we can on. Then on top of that, it's just bumpy, steep, dark. Usually it's on north facing slopes. You can't see much. They have the gates set and you get to slide down beforehand and you have to convince yourself of what you want to do, what is possible, what you're capable of. And you brainwash yourself. If I found there were times where I was at a place where I wasn't that confident, but I think I did well because I convinced myself I could do it. And I look back at it and I'm just like, wow, you were so out of control, dude. I have this conviction, like, this is what I'm going to do. And Steven, you got this. And I would actually take photos of on my phone of kind of each initiation point, looking at the new, or at each transition, looking at the new initiation point. And I just throw my energy to those areas. And I would just flip through my phone and kind of brainwash myself. That's where you need to go. That's where you need to go. That's where you need to go. And instead of getting that one inspection, which you typically get before your run, I would have five inspections. I could, if I had a question, I could go back to that zone and look at it and be like, okay, that's where I'm going to go. If I have this issue, this is kind of my alternate route. And so once you get into the race, it's already there. It's second nature. It's ingrained in your brain. And you're just trying to go as fast as possible instead of thinking about how to approach this, how to move technically, blah, blah, blah. It's just like, no, I prepared all summer long. I trust myself. I trust my abilities. Like it's just on. And I'm just trying to move my mass down the mountain as fast as I can.
And so you're on this unforgiving concrete block of ice that's waving and bumpy for what
about rough 2 minutes, roughly.
Yeah.
The longest downhill is around 2.5 minutes. Shortest is about minute 30, minute 45, depends on weather starts and all this stuff. And then they have red fencing along the sides. So if you fall, you're not going to go into the trees. But those fences, when you hit them, they can take you and twist you. And that's usually don't hurt yourself when you fall. It's when you hit the fence, it just like rips a leg this way or flips you into an awkward position. And all of a sudden your knee's torn and stuff like that.
Yeah. And what are your speeds in these types of courses?
In Vengen, Switzerland, that's the fastest race. We hit over 100 miles an hour, 2017 or 18. And yeah, we usually average around 60, 70 the whole way down. But there's certain sections where we'll hit 90 to 100.
Yeah. Well, and you've talked about, and
the cool part is you're there and you're like, at least when you're on, you're like, how do I go faster?
Yeah.
Getting tighter and tighter and tighter in these sections. And you're like, wow, I know I'm hitting around 100 right now, but I'm trying to go as fast as I can.
Yeah. Well, and you're a big guy, you're 6'4" maybe. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, large frame, which weight obviously is going to help you go fast, but body mass is going to prevent you from going, you know, resist. Yeah. Wind resistance. Yeah. Is going to,
aerodynamics is compromised.
Right. And so
I can put on more weight.
Yeah. But you learned how to really keep an aerodynamic position and be extremely fast.
I tried, but you're getting bucked and kicked every which way. You're resisting gravity. The hill's falling away. It's tilting back. You're adapting all the time. We actually go to these wind tunnels and test our body position, but we're rarely actually in that proper position. But at this wind tunnel in Buffalo we go to, this guy Mike, he's just a mad professor. He actually tested supersonic missiles. And he built a tunnel on the side for Olympians, and he did bobsled and luge and skiing. And we'd crawl in there and get in our position and test all this stuff. But he had an algorithm where you could enter the pitch of the slope, the distance of the course, the wind resistance, and your weight. There might have been one other factor, but I could change my drag by like a pound with a certain position, which you really cannot hold. Like, to keep your elbows in is a big difference than keeping them out. Like, rarely can you hold this position. But if you added 5 pounds to your frame, that's constant time the whole way down, no matter what body position you're in. So that would actually save you 0.2 of a second no matter what. So that's kind of cool. So you try and get big, but you had to find that balance of like, how big can I be? Can I carry that weight all the way down this 2.5 minute course? Or like my fighting weight was between 220 and 225. If I got above 225, I'd get too tired. But I'd be really fast on the flat.
Well, you talk about how you could get really mangled when you crash and hit into those fences and stuff. What are some of the setbacks that you had? And then, you know, how did you get through those? And what were some of the lessons learned? And
I broke both my legs, torn both my Achilles, blown both my knees, broke a lot of ribs, broke both my hands. Done a lot.
Hopefully not all at once.
Yeah, nothing was multiple. Nothing was multiple. So
well, and what I'm curious about is when something like that happens, and you know what's going on. One, you've got to physically recover from that, and then two, you've got to mentally manage that. And so what are those experiences like? And then what did you learn and come out with from
that? Maybe I'm mad, but I'm instantly like when I crashed in Garmisch 2017, I tore my ACL, MCL, PCL, LCL. I did everything in this knee. And I was just instantly like, okay, what do I do to come back? Like, what's next? That was my first thought. I'm just like, okay, maybe I'm crazy. I don't know, but it's the love of the sport, the puzzle, the complexity of it that drives me. Some people just be scared, but I know that if I am prepared, if I put the work in, I understand what it takes. If my body is there, I can be good enough and I'm fine. And it may happen again, and I'm willing to risk that. And fortunately, that's all that happened, which is a lot. But it all comes back to how fortunate I am to do what I do. I love traveling the world and pushing my limits. And I knew there was a finite time that I had to do that. And so I had to get back to work to rebuild my body. And I also knew that if my body was given the right materials to rebuild, it would rebuild. Or at least I believe that. And maybe that's why I did it. But maybe some people are negative and don't trust it, and that can affect it. But I also was fortunate to meet a ton of incredible people through these unfortunate events that helped me throughout my entire career. Some of them right here in Utah, Craig Buehler, I started using in 2004. And this guy is a wizard. He's a muscle guru that can isolate every single muscle in your body and determine if it's working or not, and would just bring balance to me. And it gave me confidence. He was Stockton and Malone's right-hand guy. He's a chiropractor in Kaysville and in Draper. And he was Stockton Malone's right-hand guy, and they played in their 40s. I mean, Stockton's assist and steals records are going to be very hard to touch. And I ski raced into my 40s, which is very rare. So I attribute a lot of that longevity to him, but I wouldn't have met him if I didn't break my leg, get a rod put in, taken out, and I was in a ton of pain and just searching for anything and everything. So through those unfortunate events, I look back and I'm like, oh, that wouldn't have happened, this wouldn't have happened, and that wouldn't have led to this success in the future. So I never let it get me too down. I trusted what was going on, and I just knew that if I'd put forth my best effort and ask for help from other people, it would usually work out.
Yeah, I hear you repeat a few things that I think are really awesome is doing the work and trusting in the work that you've done, kind of thematically, is you say, well, if I give my body what it needs, you know, nutrition and exercise, and you know, and then I trust the work and training that I've done all summer long.
And recovery.
Gotta
recover.
And recovery. Yeah. And then when you're sitting in that course that is terrifying you to death when you're when you're inspecting the course, you can say, hey, no, I can trust what I've
prepared.
What I've prepared.
Yep.
And you know, and I hear people say that you know, it's a type of courage where I don't think fear is a bad thing. I think fear is a requisite for courage. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no courage where there isn't fear, and you can step into that and have confidence in going into the unknown, and then experience what it's got waiting for you.
And what's the saying, like, the best luck comes from preparation or something like that, you know, like that's so true. And I've had coaches that are like, oh, maybe the stars aligned today. And it's like the stars align because you align the stars. Like if you do the work and you put everything in place and we are ready, you're going to do well. Your likelihood of doing well is much, much higher than kind of being there hoping for the best. Like I hated living that way. And we had a couple of years where that was kind of the attitude. And I was like, this isn't good enough. I'm not here to hope. I'm here to win and to really maximize my potential. And that comes from understanding. And you have to be a student of whatever you're trying to achieve. You have to really tear it down. A guy that really changed my mindset on that, his name's Craig Manning. Do you know him?
I do know Craig. He's actually our neighbor.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah,
I know Craig well.
Craig just was just like, all right, man, he's Australian. He's like, all right, like it's all about the subconscious. You gotta really understand and trust the work and understand the work and put it in and know and just like reiterate it, make it a habit, make it habitual. Like really just know that when you get in that situation, you're going to be okay because you understand that this is your foundation and you're not having to force things to happen. It's gonna happen. So you can just focus on the execution, essentially. You have an understanding and a trust, and you just focus on the execution. That's it.
You've had amazing people support and believe in you and help you along the way. Craig Manning wrote an amazing book called The Fearless Mind. If you want to look that up, it's really good. So I know there were some other important people in your life, some who I know pretty well, your mom and dad. So because I happen to know them,
yeah,
and that they have different personalities. Like, how were they
a little bit
in their different ways impactful to you in encouragement and support?
So my dad is the methodical one. My dad's the one who really taught me to gain understanding and think about the situation and create a plan. And my mom was very just go for it, Stephen. Like now it's time to let loose and go. And she also wouldn't show fear either. Like, even though she had it, she was incredible in that way. She'd come to Kitzbühel, which is the gnarliest event. You go 0 to 60 in under 3 seconds out of the gate. It's just, and then you jump off a 170-foot jump and it just, you disappear. It's crazy. It's so intense at the start. My mom was there. And one year my mom was in the finish and my friend, a teammate, Scott McCartney, crashed and went into a coma actually for a while. It's like convulsing in the finish and I still hadn't raced yet. And I knew she was at the finish and I was just like, all right, dude, like just make it down. I know your mom's stressing. And my mom is like, Stephen, you got this. Like, push your limits, go faster. And I'm like, all right. Knowing my mom isn't freaking out, like help me ensure myself that I'm capable, you know? But then after the fact, like when I retired, she's like, Stephen, I was so scared every time you went down that course. But she just wouldn't show that fear. And that made a big difference. Yeah. And she, growing up as a kid, like I believed it because she was a ski or she was a bike racer on the side, just locally. But at the beginning of mountain biking, she'd just be crushing all the dudes. Like we go enter these bike races and my mom would be passing all the guys. And I'm like, my mom is tough. And she broke her leg. One leg's an inch and a half shorter than the other. She has this like waddle, but she'll run a half marathon. She still rips at skiing and just doesn't let anything slow her down. And so when she's to show me that confidence through action. And so when she tells it to me and looks me in the eye, like that's when I'm like, yes, it's on.
It's on. What?
I know my mom is so rad.
She is rad. I mean, if anybody knows Becky Nyman, I mean, just excitement and joy and like, let's go. And and then your dad is. I mean, we said of ski school, his whole career, your whole life, and you know, I learned how to turn on skis because of your dad. You know, you know things.
And he's
like
the
this.
One that. It's methodical and can break it down and explain how to create this move and what the reaction will be. And he's a teacher.
Yeah.
Even though my mom was the actual teacher, she also taught high school. But my dad taught skiing and broke it down and just lives for that sort of stuff. So Yes, it's cool to have those mirrors and the yin and yang that really balance each other out. And I'd say I kind of have that in my current life.
Yeah, so. I'd like to hear about that because your wife is also a professional skier. You've got kids of your own, and so now it's your turn. Mm-hmm. And so what's this life outside of skiing? Which I guess skiing is still a big part of all of it, but mm-hmm. you're a dad. And
yeah, so my wife was in the movies, big mountain skier, heli ski, Alaska world champion. Like, she was very good, almost made the US team, technically incredibly sound, beautiful skier, but very methodical, very thoughtful. Currently, she'd hate me to say this, but she graduated Dartmouth and Wharton, worked at McKinsey. She's business mind, thinks of all the different angles, anything that could go wrong, anything that could go right, all the situations, organize everything in advance. And I'm kind of like, well, we'll jump in and whatever comes, I'll figure it out and I'll muscle it type attitude. So we have two daughters. To instill that sort of both worlds on the girls is important to me. And especially on our first daughter, she was very cautious. And I was just like, the more you push that way, I'm going to push even further this way. And I do not want her to lean that way. I want her to understand both worlds. And I want her to really think about the situation, but be free and confident. And so I think it's really cool to have that attitude and different perspectives from each parent. I look at how I got to my success and I'm just like, how did I? Like, I was never the craziest. I was never the one that's willing to risk the most. A bunch of my friends like jumping on the tramp and doing these double flips and triple flips. And I never would try that. It's just, it wasn't me. And I was quite calculated. Like, it's funny to say, cause I was in one of the craziest sports you can pursue, but I was very calculated and all came from preparation and belief and I think approach. But when it came down to performing, I understood what I was trying to do and I went for it. And I look back at all those guys that had that just go for it type attitude. I don't know if their parents were different or whatever, or both of the same and both kind of push them down that arena, but or push them with that mentality. But like, a lot of them got hurt. A lot of these kids that were more talented than me would just push beyond their limits and get hurt and never really made it because of injury and this or that. Or maybe they realized like, okay, this is too much. And I don't know if I articulated that well, but basically my parents with those two perspectives helped me kind of calculate these very kind of intense approaches and really charged at them with confidence.
Yeah, Steve.
That was all over the place.
It was beautiful. Don't believe anything different. Hey, this has been really fun for me and really meaningful. I'm so glad you came. And
Randy, thanks for having me.
Maybe I'll follow you up to Sundance today and and steal a couple turns with you. If you'll do a wedge for me, then I can keep up with you. I've got one last question for you mm-hmm. before we're done. Steve, what does gratitude mean to you?
I've been all over the place with religion. I grew up Mormon and I pray. I believe in God and my prayers consist of gratitude. And it's just being able to step back and look at my life and just say, hey, you have it very well. And I feel like when I do that every day and just look at like, especially when you have kids and you're in a relationship and it's just this battle and things go sideways or something comes out of your mouth that you're just like, oh, that's not good. Here it comes. That's going to bite me. There are times where it's tough and you're raising little humans. I say prayers every night, just stepping back and looking at, okay, what were the good things about today? What are the good things about my life? What are the good things about my partner and my kids? And if you're frustrated, like if I feel frustration for one particular thing, I pinpoint that and I just zoom out and I'm like, what is good about that? What can that teach me? And that really brings a calmness to me toward everything that's going on. I mean, life is so complex compared to when we were kids, you know, and it just seems to get more and more complex as time goes on. So it's just gratitude to me is something that keeps me grounded and keeps me positive and moving forward and happy. And I'm a pretty happy person.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy that you could share some time with us, and I'm grateful for you, Stephen.
Hey, yeah. Randy, thanks for reaching out. Grateful for you too.
You're awesome. And folks, remember, if you like this, tell us. Subscribe, like it, leave us a note. And the more people that do, the more awesome guests like Stephen we can bring on here. So we love you, and we'll see you next time.